Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, science is under attack. Who and what are behind the attacks? And how can we restore the public's understandings about scientific realities? Lee McIntyre is with us. He is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University and a recent lecturer on ethics at Harvard Extension School. He's the author of How to Talk to a Science Denier, Post-Truth, and the forthcoming on disinformation. Christopher Reddy also joins us. He is a senior scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and a faculty member at MIT. He is the author of Science Communication in a Crisis, An Insider's Guide. Thank you both so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. Both of you work on aspects of communication and crises, but in different ways. So what I wanted to do was start with the crises, talk about the crises before us, and then talk about how we got here, and finally go to potential solutions for solving these crises. And as we were talking before we started recording, you have both studied and written about different aspects of communication. And so there may be some disagreement, which I think is actually a good thing. So Lee McIntyre, I think I wanted to start with you because in your intro, I think this was your latest book, How to Talk with a Science Denier, you said because of this crises, really, we can't give up on persuading science deniers and teaching about what science is and what reality is, because there's too much at stake. I wonder if you can start there with what are the stakes at the moment? Why must we all engage in restoring scientific understandings? What's the cost?
The problem is that I think that the dialogue has gotten so virulent, people have gotten so polarized about factual issues that they stop talking to one another. And there's now some empirical work which shows that that's a mistake. That is that by talking to one another, it actually leads to good things. And that the thing that I was the most interested in, it bears on my research, is a study in Nature in 2019 by Cornelia Bache and Philip Schmid, which gave the first empirical evidence to show that you could change a science denier's mind. And that really, to me, says that we all need a hand in this. And the most exciting part of that study, too, is there were two ways to do it. One was content rebuttal, which was the experts. Then there's something called technique rebuttal. So that, you know, anybody who is interested to learn how to do that, basically to talk not about what they believe, but why they believe it, can have an influence. And the influence was the same in its scope. So this is for everyone. And I'll make a provocative challenge. If we don't, we're science deniers, because the Bache and Schmid study showed we can make a difference. And so anytime a scientist or anyone else says, oh, it's not worth talking to these people, I wouldn't make any difference, they're wrong.
Christopher Reddy, what would you say to that?
I totally agree. I tend to be a little bit more hopeful. I think the only thing I would do is I would switch out not how to talk. We kept saying talk. I would say, how do we listen? And for scientists, not lecture. I think that often a lot of my colleagues might think that folks who are science deniers are not smart. I don't think that's necessarily true. I tend to think that these folks are just getting their information from a different platform, or maybe, as Al Gore so aptly put, it's an inconvenient truth. But I tend to believe I have a lot more hope if we are just willing to listen and not rely on complicated models and XY charts and acronyms as a way to make compelling arguments for the betterment of society and Earth.
So perhaps we can start to dig into some of the problems that we face. And we'll start with disinformation, which is Lee McIntyre's area. And then we'll go into kind of the broader perspective that Christopher Reddy, you do with, you know, the process, the scientific process, the incentives, the media. We'll just talk about all of it. So let's start with disinformation itself. And Lee McIntyre, you talk about its intention. Sometimes it's about money, but sometimes it's about power. And, you know, you use the industry's, you know, anti-science on smoking as one campaign, which is an old campaign. But you also noted Russia and its efforts to essentially destabilize science in the U.S. Can you talk about the different sources of disinformation, the motivations, and maybe even how much money is behind it, if you know?
It's dark money, so it's hard to know. They like to hide it. Most important thing to remember about disinformation is that it's not misinformation. Misinformation is a mistake, but disinformation is a lie. And if there's a lie, there has to be a liar and a motivation. So, you know, what was the motivation behind the tobacco companies wanting to doubt or raise doubt where there really was none? Over whether there was a link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer. Well, it's obvious what their motivation was. It was money. It was the ability to continue to sell cigarettes. Notice they didn't have to prove that smoking didn't cause lung cancer. They just had to raise enough doubt to make it sound like, you know, scientists weren't sure. And that paved the way for a lot of what came later. And I think that a lot of people paid attention to that. The fossil fuel companies were paying attention to that strategy about climate change. And then something interesting too, you brought up Russia. Well, Russia, of course, invented modern disinformation warfare in the 1920s. So, I mean, that predates even this tobacco meeting in 1953. And there was a terrific article in the New York Times in 2019 called Putin's Long War Against American Science. Now, that may shock people. They wonder, why would he not like American science? Well, part of disinformation warfare is to undermine the trusted institutions of your opponent, to make it so that they're not really sure what's true, what's false. And they started probably before this, but the one that people will remember is the all of the conspiracy theories about AIDS in the 1980s, those were a result of Russian disinformation campaign. And so what that article shows, there's a financial aspect to this too, but not just power, not just ideology. The interesting part is it goes up to the present day. One of the most shocking things that I discovered in research for my newest book is that everybody's heard of by now the idea that the false idea that there are microchips in the COVID vaccines. Where did that come from? If you trace it back, it came from a Russian troll farm. That was something that was published in an English language propaganda arm of the SVR, which is, you know, an offshoot of the old KGB. And it was in this publication that said, you know, it was in April 2020, and they said, you know, think about that, April 2020, they said any future vaccines developed in the West will have tracking microchips in them, courtesy of Bill Gates, who has patent 666 on this technology. Well, you know, talk about rabble-rousing, and then share on Facebook, share on Twitter, which people did. By May 2020, 40% of Republican voters thought there was something to that, and 28% of overall voters thought there was something to that. So disinformation is extremely dangerous, and I've come to believe that disinformation is the prime driver of denial, science denial in particular, the first thing that I thought of, but then also reality denial, election denial. That, you know, the sorts of things you see in American politics today, it's based on disinformation. It doesn't always have to be foreign. It can be domestic. Anytime somebody is motivated to want to create an army of disbelievers, they do it through disinformation.
The other thing that you noted in your book was that there's really an effort to sow division, that to build distrust, to demonize.
Yes.
And sadly, while there is that, and that may be a goal of some perhaps Russian disinformation developers, others feed on it. Others make money on that.
That's right.
In the U.S. Can you speak to that at all?
disinformation has two goals. One is to get you to believe something false, and the other is to polarize you, to hate and distrust the people who disagree with you. That's very useful. You know, if you're going to create that kind of us versus them, other people can exploit it. Other people can take advantage of it. And so a lot of times disinformation widens a crack that's already there, but then it's picked up by the partisans who widen it even further, who amplify it on, you know, certain cable TV networks and on social media. And the problem gets worse and worse. The problem is that there's a kind of a feedback loop, because the disinformers, you know, capitalize on polarization that's already there, but they make it worse, until you get to the point where it's us versus them. And once it's reached that point over factual issues, I think democracy's in trouble. And the subtitle of my new book on disinformation is How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy. Because I don't think it's just science that's at risk. I think democracy is at risk when we can't agree about facts.
Christopher Reddy, this is a perfect bring-in for you, because you talk about all these other systems that kind of intersect with disinformation and even misinformation. You talk about, you know, how the science process works and how that feeds into it, the secrecy that kind of comes out of it, competition maybe between scientists, the pressure to publish, and then some of the challenges on scientists, including legal and harassment. So why don't we kind of go through how this environment then makes it hard to do what Lee McIntyre is talking about, which is especially for scientists, but for all of us, to be able to debunk or pre-bunk disinformation.
First of all, I'm totally enjoying this conversation and I'm learning so much from Lee, because I'm just a boots on the ground chemist. You know, I just study oil spills and pollution, and just kind of a Forrest Gump of my life ended up meeting all these different people and just talking about my experiences. So this has been, you know, really exciting and a little scary, but certainly learned a lot. So I mean, happy to talk more, but I mean, ultimately, you know, my take on misinformation, I never really thought much about disinformation, is simply as a scientist who finds himself in the middle of oil spills and other crises, that often folks want to know what the science can tell them. And it's a non-trivial effort to try to get the right science in the right place to the right people, packaged in a way that can be used in a meaningful, beneficial way. And those are big challenges. I think, you know, answering to what Lee said, when I hear all that's going on, I think one of the ways that scientists in general have made misinformation and likely disinformation, I hadn't thought much about it, is when they're interviewed. And a lot of scientists are so worried about what their colleagues are going to think of them when the first lead question is. So you throw out the softball, right? The big picture, and we start saying, I don't know. We don't know this, we don't know this, we don't know this, we don't know this. And that's because we're worried about our colleagues thinking that we're hacks. But when the expert with the PhD, the blah, 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 leads off an interview by saying, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, then you've left your audience hungry. And a hungry audience starts to find other places to be nourished. Sure. And I think that's what, you know, certainly the bigger challenge is that Lee's talking about there. Again, I'm not a scholar like that, but I see it happen time and time again, where my colleagues worry about the wrong audience. They're worried about our colleagues instead of the people that we want to be in informing so that we have a better society.
Well, the colleagues matter, of course, because scientists' careers are, of course, based on them. I mean, and you even brought up in your book Carl Sagan and the word that came out of how he was denied tenure, and which was being Saganized because he was a science communicator. Maybe that would be a good example to talk about.
I'm going to say Carl like I've met him, but I never met him. But I mean, you know, Carl's big challenges in the 60s as a brilliant scientist and, you know, in the mix of NASA upstarts was he was just an incredibly creative thinker. He was way outside the box. He just was so talented about thinking about from different perspectives. And in reality, his bigger challenges about being denied tenure at Harvard was that he was so outside the box. He was so creative and he was so willing to think in a non-academic way. You know, he eventually was denied tenure at Harvard. He bounced back like a rock star that he was at Cornell. And then he really found his footing to do what Carl Sagan excelled at. But at the end of the day, Carl and other scientists along the way who have tried to do outreach and have many cases succeeded have felt the cold fist of their colleagues.
Yeah.
But I am hopeful that academia is a little bit more accepting of efforts to work outside the ivory tower.
This is the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with Lee McIntyre and Christopher Reddy about disinformation and how can we restore the public's understandings about scientific realities. There were some examples, of course, like Richard Feynman, right? So Richard Feynman was both the preeminent scientist with QED in physics, but he also was a real star in terms of science communication. But not everybody can do that. Not everybody can do both of those. And then, there's all the harassment. You noted that, Christopher Reddy, in your book a little bit. And I wrote about ClimateGate and the so-called ClimateGate and how they went after scientists over the so-called trick, the statistical trick, which was a phrase that was used in their emails. So talk a little bit about the harassment that has happened of scientists.
At the end of the day, I think we return back to money. If a scientist's findings doesn't necessarily align with the betterment of some group that sees value, whether it's in power or money, then, there's an opportunity to exploit it. And, unfortunately, scientists in the United States are not well protected. There is no science confidentiality rule. If somebody wants to look at your data, they can get it. I've dealt with that myself. You are pretty, pretty exposed, even to the point where, and I think this is one of the biggest challenges I've had is, sharing your data is one thing, sharing your emails is one thing, but then when folks want to see every version of a research paper that you wrote, and they want to attack the 12th draft of 50 drafts and go into the track changes in the comments and look to see whether or not there was some shenanigans. And, that's a problem because you're impinging on the deliberative process. And that give and take that scientists are so comfortable having, we're showing doubt and being uncertain and just being an incredible, cynic about the work and skeptical, that gets exploited when it leaves the playground of scientists. And I think, that is a challenge. And scientists are still not protected. We don't have that same protections that the media has or, physicians.
I think that is absolutely correct in the exploitation of the process by those who might be able to benefit from it. And I think, Lee McIntyre, you were talking about that in terms of using doubt, for example, in the campaigns. And they tended to be the same, PR agencies that did these campaigns,
yes,
sowing doubt because scientific process is really this long drawn out and uncertainty is kind of built into it, but people don't understand that. And people don't understand the peer review process. So maybe one of the failures is as a society, not really teaching people about the scientific process.
Boy, I think that's absolutely true. And Chris, so much respect for what you do. I'm a philosopher of science. And so I admire scientists. I'm a fan of Carl Sagan too. I mean, I love what he said about how important it is for scientists to be open, but also skeptical and how to, balance those two things. And I wrote a book just a couple of books ago called The Scientific Attitude, where I made the argument that what's really crucial about science is not scientific method, like there's some recipe you could follow, but the attitude that scientists have of caring about evidence and being willing to change their mind based on new evidence. And that's, I think, the answer to the question that you just raised, which is that the people who are looking for the 12th draft and something to criticize, they already know what they want to be true. And they're trying to cherry pick and conspiracy theory their way into embarrassing scientists because they think that that sort of personal attack is going to be some sort of, to show that they're right. So one thing that I've done in my own work is to make the argument that, because I do talk to science deniers, and the thing that I want to point out to them is, it's not that you have a bad theory or that you don't have any evidence, even though that's usually the case. It's that you're not willing to change your mind when you tell me, you know, when I provide you evidence that shows that you're wrong. And I think that's what needs to be taught in school. I remember in elementary school, admiring scientists. In fact, what was my choice? Because in elementary school, I studied science appreciation. I didn't study science. We were made to think that these were the geniuses of all time. They had discovered truth. How lucky were we to be born into the era in which all truth had been discovered? Look what they found. They didn't teach us how to be scientists or how to be skeptical, like Carl Sagan brought up. And you know, and I think that holds over to deniers. So, you know, Chris, you talked earlier about, you know, scientists getting, you know, under the hot lights and, you know, worrying about the audience of their peers, but they're being watched also by the lay public who don't understand the process of science. And so when they, you brought this up, when they hear somebody, when they hear a scientist say, "I don't know," they think, "Oh, well, then my hypothesis is just as good." But I'm going to make a proposal that was just as deadly, is for the scientist to say, "I'm absolutely certain and I can prove it." Because if you do that, then you not only lose your colleagues who know that's probably not true, then you've really cut yourself off from the scientific attitude of being able to say, "And if the evidence changes, I will change my mind." Because science is really not about proof and certainty. It's about warrant. It's about the ability, you know, how strong is your belief conditioned on the evidence? But if the evidence changes, you've got to be able to change your belief. That's the one thing that I think deniers really don't get. They don't understand that it's the height of being a scientist to be flexible enough of mind to say, I think what John Maynard Keynes said in economics, he said, "When the facts change, I change my mind, sir. What do you do?" And what's your alternative? Just to go back and say, "Oh no, here in the 12th draft, you know, there was this little you know, thought bubble between the two scientists where they made a joke, and that shows they're in a conspiracy and they're wrong." You're just never going to get to empirical truth that way. So great, you know, Chris, you embody the values that I admire in scientists because you're so humble. And, you know, but what you say, there's a lot of wisdom in it.
Can I just riff off that? I mean, I think, you know, Lee just nails it. You know, at the end of the day, the lay public thinks that science is a house of cards and that if there's one paper or something wrong, then the whole world falls down. And that's just not the way it is. Science is this beautifully elegant jigsaw puzzle that is ever expanding, incremental, and self-correcting. And it maybe once in a while, we all put the wrong piece in the wrong place, but we sit back, we figure out it's the wrong place, we put it back in there. And that's how science works. You know, it's okay to make a mistake as long as it's decent and honest, because eventually science will catch up with it. You know, it's being nimble and open-minded. And, you know, I couldn't agree more. You know, the problem is, I blame Steve Jobs, and I'm being a little joking here, but the iPhone and the willingness for the public to go to Wikipedia and get an answer for something that's certain, how many people were at the Red Sox game, whatever, right? Yesterday, that the public gets an answer in 4 seconds and they have no doubt. And then they live with that. And, you know, that's a problem when everybody wants something that's absolutely certain in 4 seconds, package it away and move on. And science is not built for speed and certainly not for the way in which it moves forward, that it's really 100% certain and you can't really give an answer in 4 seconds. So those are challenges. It's not that science is bad. It's just, you know, some things are good when it's slow. And I think science is one of them.
I would agree. I think other complications, of course, you mentioned the Steve Jobs and Wikipedia, is that traditional media is also built on an economic model. Sure. And they make their money from eyeballs. And so they want the sound bites and the conflict and the negativity. And therefore, you know, the way science is articulated doesn't fit into that, you know, sound bite. It doesn't fit into the expedience. It doesn't fit into the conflict model in the same way. It's a different kind of conflict. So it's not usually sensational until you have what happened yesterday with, you know, the announcement about the oceans being so hot that you shouldn't be in it in mm-hmm. certain parts of the world. So, yeah, I think all of these are parts of the problem. And I don't know if both of you talked about this or it was one of you, but, you know, our educational institutions, you know, the failures there are part of the problem as well. So it really calls for an overhaul. And so maybe that's the cue for us to start talking about solutions. And Lee McIntyre, I thought before we can talk about solutions, you said it's really important to understand the five tropes of denialist reason. You talked about two of them already. Yeah. Why don't you tell us, explain what these are? And then I think you also talked about denialism and identity.
Yes.
And I think it's important. Yeah. I would agree with you that identity is a big source of adherence to denialism. So if you want to tie all that together, I think it'd be really useful.
Yeah, so this isn't my own work. I'm quoting somebody else's work here on the five tropes of science denial. This was the Mark and Chris Hufnagel and later developed by some later cognitive scientists. And what they found is that all science deniers, whether it's evolution denial, climate denial, anti-vax, flat earth, it's the same style of reasoning. And by the way, this is what technique rebuttal is. It's understanding these five tropes so that you can use them. Every science denier cherry picks evidence. They believe in conspiracy theories. They engage in illogical reasoning. They rely on fake experts and tend to denigrate real experts. And this is my favorite. They think that science has to be perfect in order to be credible. and you can almost see, and you're, Chris, you're laughing, right? Because it's almost like, how can people be so virulent and angry at scientists? It's because it's like the lover spurned, right? They expected you to be perfect and you weren't perfect. The identity comes in because, you know, when somebody engages in that kind of reasoning, they're really not interested in finding the truth. They're interested in confirming what they already believe. You know, they're not. I've had flat earthers say, you know, well, we're the real scientists. We're the real skeptics. Well, they're certainly not. They're not skeptical of the things that they want to believe. They're only skeptical of the things they don't want to believe. And when you get locked in with that kind of reasoning, where you're just engaging in confirmation bias, that becomes who you are. Then your beliefs are not just what you believe. And if the evidence changes, you change your belief. Your beliefs are who you are, so you're reluctant to change them because that would mean admitting that you're wrong and, you know, kind of humiliating yourself. This is the way science deniers tend to look at it, right? A lot is on the line for them. This is one of the things that I admire the most about scientists, the ability, you know, to work for a decade on something, have somebody else disprove it and say, congratulations, you disproved me, I was wrong. That is so noble to be able to do that. And that is not something that I see in the denialist community. So it's really important when you speak to them. And this was not part of the Bates and Schmidt study. This is something that I tried on my own. Michael Shermer has talked about it. There's some anecdotal literature. It's what Chris was saying before. You've got to listen. You've got to be calm and patient and respectful and listen to what they have to say, because cramming facts down their throat is not going to work. What is going to work is, and this, the anecdotal literature shows this, every science denier, and I mean sometimes really hardcore, who has changed their mind, it's been as a result of somebody who took the time and was patient that they trusted, and then they changed their own mind. I had a slogan that I came up with in the book, How to Talk to a Science Denier. Science denial is not about facts, it's about trust. They don't trust scientists. And so if you don't trust the scientists, then why would their facts convince you? So if you as a scientist go in thinking, this person is just like my colleagues, but they're not listening, so I'll just ram the facts down their throat, it just makes them angry. And it just makes you look arrogant, even if you've got the goods, because they're not listening. So Chris, I couldn't agree more that I actually went to a Flat Earth convention in 2018, and the title of my book shouldn't. People misinterpret the title of my book as how to convince a science denier, because that's, you can't necessarily do it. I wanted to learn how to talk to them. And, you know, you put your finger on it. The way to talk to somebody to get them to listen is to first listen to them. If you listen to what somebody else thinks, then you show them respect and then maybe they'll hear it. But it's really on them. You can't force them. And unfortunately, the other thing in addition to identity is community. An awful lot of people believe the things that the other people in their community believe. And so they're getting a lot of reinforcement on social media, on cable news, in their, you know, political community for believing the wrong things. And why should they believe the scientists?
There are two things about that. One is the work of George Lakoff that shows, you know, your neurology actually changes in this process of being steeped, right? But the other is from the social scientists, the social psychologists, to show group identity also matters. So it's not just that individual identity of the humiliation, but it's also like being part of a group. You know, and there's some evidence in the political literature that people even form their policy preferences based on their group identity. Like once they're part of this, you know, then they form their ideas based on that. But what I'd like to do is actually kind of keep going down this path of solutions. And Christopher Reddy, one of the things I liked about what you were trying to do in your book was say, you know, maybe there are some ways we can meet people where they are. Each of these stakeholders in this process have particular goals, and sometimes a scientist can help them meet their goals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, scientists have to recognize, just like everybody else, that any potential group has their own value system of what they decide is success, their willingness of patience, their sensitivity to uncertainty. And, you know, scientists would be better suited when they understood each one of these different groups and how they can nourish them. You know, looking towards solutions, I first have to say that I feel absolutely terrible for these science deniers because they've literally taken the fun out of science. I mean, you know, this great chase to find the answer. Like every day my life is, you know, this hunt for an answer, and it's just a fantastic ride. And I hear what these folks are doing, and it's literally taken the fun out of it and just how much it is fun to explore. So I wish that they could have more fun. And then we would be better off. But, you know, returning to what Lee said, I give advice to junior scientists, and, you know, they all want to get, you know, and the upside is, you know, from a solution base, then the current generation of scientists do value this aspect of outreach. And, you know, my advice to them is to start very local. And because local, which means go find out who your local radio station is, go talk to your local fire department chief, find out what the value system of all these different players who might be going on, whether it's a crisis or an event, go talk to your town manager and build a rapport, because it's low risk, high reward for all these scientists. You're more likely somebody's going to call you back. But I mean, I think on a much broader scale, we nail this, is this sense of trust in community. And I think one of the shortfalls of the pandemic in science communication was that I think a lot of folks, you know, don't want to hear me living in Cape Cod with my Rhode Island accent and my PhD when they're living in some place halfway around the country. You know, that we have no connection. We have no sense of trust. And I think we would have been better off if we built a cadre of local scientists who understood the community, who understood their value system on a smaller scale and identified a way in which you could get a more positive outcome. And so trust, respect, and community building is a much more effective way than telling somebody that you get your PhD at Harvard, you postdoc to Caltech, and now you're in the tenure track at Stanford. It just doesn't matter. But finding with these common grounds is where you have the greatest success.
When we come back, while we face catastrophic climate change and other pending disasters, what will it take to restore the public's understandings of scientific realities? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with Lee McIntyre and Christopher Reddy about disinformation and ways to communicate with non-scientists to loosen the grip that the disinformants have on so many people. Lee McIntyre, why don't we move in a little bit to the issues related to media, social media, and AI, because you mentioned all of these.
Yeah.
Obviously, we want traditional media to tell us, you know, what's behind disinformation. But the people who are behind the disinformation have enough money to make their own media themselves, as we see, right?
Yeah.
So where do we go from there?
I think the number one thing that the media could do,
when you're talking about traditional media,
is to acknowledge that there is such a thing as disinformation. I can't tell you how many times I hear commentators use the word misinformation when they mean disinformation. And whether they do it because they don't know the difference or because they're trying not to raise any hackles or seem politically biased or, you know, to get themselves in trouble, it's really terrible because they're not reporting on the issue in the right way. And I think that if they did report it on the right way, they would tell stories like the stories that Chris just told. One of my favorite stories along those lines is Jim Bridenstine, who is a member of the U.S. House some years back, who was a virulent climate denier, you know, and gave a speech on the floor of the U.S. House in which he said, you know, all the things that climate deniers say. So, of course, Donald Trump appointed him to be head of NASA, because what else are you going to do with a guy like that? So he made Jim Bridenstine the director of NASA. Within weeks, Bridenstine changed his mind, gave another speech in which he said, I was wrong, climate change is real, and we're the cause of it. Now, why did he do that? That's a very optimistic story, and the media is not really telling that story. Why didn't they? Here's my theory. He changed his mind because he finally met those evil scientists that he was demonizing and distrusting. The people who distrust scientists are the people who haven't met scientists. Mm. So sometimes the outreach is, you know, as you said, Chris, you know, the scientists reach out a hand. Sometimes it's, you know, all of a sudden you're the boss of NASA and you start to meet these scientists in the hallway and you're their boss and you have lunch with them and you realize these are kind of trustworthy people who are, you know, really interested in truth. Maybe I, you know, kind of trust them a little more. And, you know, that I think that's a story that the media could tell. Now, you mentioned social media and you mentioned partisan media. Here's the trouble, because there are people who have an agenda and, you know, don't want the truth to get out. And then there are also the folks who are kind of the bystanders who could intervene, but they don't. And this is where I'm talking about the social media companies. Could they do more to crack down on disinformation? Yes, they could. A few years back, the Center for Countering Digital Hate found that 65% of the anti-vax propaganda on Twitter was due to 12 people. The night before Elon Musk took over Twitter, I checked. Eight of them still had a platform. Now, I did that because I wanted to make sure that, you know, I knew as of, you know, that marking point. But I mean, really, one of the main way, I mean, I've talked to counterintelligence officials and, you know, the cyber warriors, and one of the first things they say is you've got to deplatform the liars. You can't let them get their message out, because once their message is amplified, it's like a disease. You know, there are a certain number of people are going to get infected. So the pinch point between the people who create disinformation and the amplification and the belief is the amplification. You've got to try to choke that off to keep people from getting infected with the bad ideas. So partisan media, do you say? They lie.
Yeah, it's really difficult with the environment in the legal environment in the United States today.
Yes,
to do that, of course, and it's hard to parse out which parts promote healthy skepticism sometimes and which parts are clearly disinformation. And
not that hard.
I don't think that the executives of the you know, of the social media networks necessarily understand the difference, I guess is what I'm getting to.
I'm more cynical.
Yeah. Why am I surprised
about that? No, I'm because I'm usually a little more optimistic, but I'm cynical for the following reason. They have no trouble at all cracking down on the things that they don't want on their platform. Section 230 allows them to do so. They have no, you know, nobody can sue them for taking down content they don't agree with. They take down porn, they take down beheadings, they take down terrorism. You don't see that on your Facebook feed.
Right.
They could do the same thing for disinformation, but they don't. Why not? Because they don't want to.
They profit from it.
They profit from it. They won't tweak their algorithms, or they won't be transparent about their algorithms to let people know. And, it, you know, they could have a panel of experts, nonpartisan, black out all the user data. So, completely confidential, to just say before a whistleblower comes forward, that's dangerous. We've got to do something about it. And there are moments when they do. Right before the 2020 election, Zuckerberg, amped up the truth dial and amped down the engagement dial. And, there were some warnings on disinformation. And then immediately after the election, they took those controls off and we got January 6th. Now, I'm not saying there's, cause and effect there. I'm just saying it seems to me that when they're concerned enough, they can do a lot. And they really have, they're bystanders, they're accomplices. I think the original title of my book was Truth Killers. And I think that social media are accomplices because they're not helping the main way that we could fight disinformation. Sorry I interrupted you, but that was my soapbox because I'm so excited about the idea that there's something we can do, and I want to get that message out.
Yeah, and as I understand it, even YouTube is returning some of the election denial information back onto it where it was previously banned.
Yep.
And what about AI?
AI, I just gave a paper in which I call this the problem from hell, because to date, the main problem with disinformation is that it's not very good. They screen people for how well, in Russia, the control forms, they screen people for how well they speak English. They give them a test. They've got thousands of people working on these things. What happens when ChatGPT can do it? What happens when you can, feed in the data and it's not, I can show you some examples from the 2016 election that were memes that were laughably bad. Even those had a pretty good, effect. And they were seen by 126 million people on Facebook. What happens when the disinformation is so good that you can't tell the difference? Because the danger here, and we see this with deepfakes too. The danger is not just that you see something that's false and think it's true. It's that you begin to see something that's true and you think it's false. You get cynical, in an environment in which deepfakes are possible. ChatGPT is, on steroids. The day will come when there will be a videotape of a politician doing something despicable and they'll say that's fake and their partisans will believe it.
Yeah.
And that,
well, there's already some of that. I think even in one of the congressional hearings, they opened the congressional hearing with an AI generated.
Jamie Raskin. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And the same thing will happen with AI. With the written word. There we're talking about every communication, video, audio, and writing.
It's going to be science worse. Scientists would actually come together to have AI, to have an AI that can counter the AI.
Working on it. They are working on this. And I was very encouraged by what I read in the paper the other day about the tech executives coming together with Biden and saying, they've been saying, please regulate us, let's figure out how to do this. And they came up with some pretty good guidelines. They left a few things out, but I'm encouraged by the fact that the motivation seems to be there. They're scared. Who's that guy? I can't remember his name, the guy from Google who resigned just so he could say this is doom. You know, this is going to, I mean, I think he said that AI was an extinction level event. That gets my attention. I wish I could remember his name, but it was the night before I gave that speech, Problem from Hell, and I was sitting in a foreign country watching CNN, and here he came on to say AI was an extinction level event. Oh boy.
Christopher Reddy, anything you'd like to add?
Well, you know, I think that, and this might be sound like an after school special, but I think the best way that scientists can help overcome AI is with empathy and creativity and genuineness. All those chat GPT and all that stuff is probably pretty good, but I'm willing to wager the human component is where we can come in and help out. And I think scientists would do a lot better if we were showed empathy and then really flexed and took our creative spirit that we do every day and let it stretch out beyond that and add a sense of realism. You know, at the end of the day, and this might sound a little petty, maybe it's a little jealous, but I can't stand any of those TV shows with scientists on them because I don't think Big Bang helps out science. Now, that might be a little bit of a stretch, but I don't know many people who are Sheldon Cooper. You know, scientists I know are much more rich and much less quirky. And, you know, I understand what TV is trying to do. You know, they don't have a lot of time and, you know, they work on the extremes because that works. But, you know, scientists do a lot, but I also think they have a lot of a personal connection and a sense of genuineness and the passion and the desire that is real and palpable. And if we can get that out there and overcome this artificial, we'd be on a much better plan and route for society.
Final words, Lee McIntyre.
You know, you reminded me of something there, Chris, that I was going to say about something that you said before, which is that when a scientist is saying, I don't know, almost always the next words out of their mouth are, let's find out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Here's what we can do. Scientists are so curious and so interested because, I mean, I'm a philosopher and I understand that there's some things that are unknowable. I mean, philosophers console themselves, you know, oh, well, we're left with all the terrible problems after all the empirical disciplines take the easy stuff. I mean, we're left with the really tough stuff. And to a certain extent, I suppose that's true. But I mean, there are certain things that are unknowable because there are no data, but in science, there are data, but it's still can be difficult. And it's still, I mean, it's subtle and you've got to design your experiment well, and then be willing to live by the result. I would love for that attitude to be, you know, out in the general public more. And you know what, we could bring that same attitude to AI, to how we use AI. I read recently that, I don't want to shut down AI. I hope it didn't sound like that from what I said. They're now using AI to predict who's going to get pancreatic cancer 3 years before they get it. Pancreatic cancer is, I think, the deadliest form of cancer because they always catch it so late because what are the warning signs? But they've now used AI to pick up these warning signs 3 years in advance. I'm a cancer survivor, not pancreatic cancer, thank goodness. But I mean, I don't want to shut that down. I want there to be, you know, 1,000 flowers blooming of AI to make our life better. Disinformers will always, people with an agenda will always find a way to misuse any technology. And Chris, I like what you said. How do you fight that back? With creativity, with empathy, with, you know, curiosity. I think that's right.
You know, it's interesting. Before we started the program, Lee McIntyre, you and I were talking about, I said, you know, 12 years ago, I wrote that book, Kill the Messenger, The Media's Role in the Fate of the World. And the last chapter really talked about how the job is to build a better humanity, which is, I think, what we're both talking about, what we're all three talking about, which is, and I said, there are ways for media to contribute to building a better humanity. And I think this is something that scientists can also contribute to, is the way Christopher, you know, alluded to. And part of how they can do that is showing people how to talk to one another with disagreement, because academics disagree all the time. That's part of the nature of academia. And to be able to disagree in a way that is evidence-based and that is respectful and that doesn't attack the person is actually a step forward.
I think that's right. I mean, I was just thinking I've come to realize that the main issue with something like climate change is not that people have the wrong beliefs, it's that they don't care. Mm. How do you get someone to care? There's a philosophical problem we ought to be working on. How do you get somebody to care about something that they don't care about?
I think making it personal is one thing. Actually, Christopher Reddy, there was one other thing that you had in your book that I just didn't want to let you go before you got to address, which was about collaboration.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that any one scientist can save the day. I mean, you know, there's often thought that we're going to put a cape on, we're going to solve climate change or any of these things. At the end of the day, a scientist is not the king of the table is an opportunity to us to align with good graphic artists and good science writers and people who understand marketing and packaging. And that's not disingenuous. That's about how do we get really good science product in the right hands in the right way that can be chewed and used in a valuable way. And so I believe that scientists would be a lot better off if they reached out. And just like we might outsource, you know, an analysis, it's okay for us to hire a graphic artist to do a better job, or maybe to get a science writer to help us prove something or prepare to give an interview like this. We can't do it by ourselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, it is a village. It's very much like that. And, we shouldn't put scientists on a pedestal, but we should recognize that we can raise the pedestal for everybody if we bring them into the mix in an effective, respectful way.
And just in closing, Christopher Reddy, from your experiences with crises, you know, oil spills and disasters, what's kind of the big takeaway lesson that we can use moving forward?
You know, like it or not, that when you're in a fast moving arena of a crisis, there is no happy ending. You know, this isn't some TV show where the couple gets back together at the end. You know, we have to recognize that science in the time of and trying to help out a crisis is trying to make a bad thing from getting worse. And it is a series of decisions that is going to give the net positive outcome. And now that might be frustrating for folks. But we have to realize that when the chips are down, we do what's best to have the best beneficial outcome. And we see a lot of Monday morning quarterbacks, you know, cherry picking some, going back to one of the five, cherry picking a decision without realizing the bigger picture, that we work in the net and we balance our checkbook more than just every day. And we have to realize that and really underscore the significance that there are a lot of great scientists. I think, you know, going back to the NASA administrator, he was changed because he met the United States government's rank and file scientists who are outstanding. Yes. And, you know, if we could trust them a little bit more, give them a little bit more credence, we'd all be a little better off.
Yeah, it's interesting because the academy itself is being maligned. And that's the exact same thing where because people don't meet us. They don't meet the people who are involved in trying to answer these questions and I would argue most people trying to, you know, make a positive difference in some way or another. Yeah.
You know, I don't wear a white lab coat and purple gloves every day. I don't try to tell everybody I'm a scientist, but if somebody, I end up talking to somebody on the beach and you tell them you're a scientist, most people really are excited to talk to you. They have so many questions. And we just got to figure out how we connect the passion of curiosity with the passion of scientists. And, you know, I really, truly believe there's a lot to be had there.
Do you have business cards, Chris? do you carry business cards? I've often
on the beach.
Well, I've maintained that scientists need business cards to hand out to the public. Because, I went to the March for Science in Boston. And, you know, there were 1,000 scientists who were all talking to, I'm not a scientist, but I mean, they were all talking to one another. Okay. If they had gone out, you know, to other places so that people could meet a scientist, I think that would be great.
And you're absolutely right. And I will tell somebody if I meet them, especially if I'm busy or maybe with my kids or wherever, I do carry business cards a lot. And I will say, listen, email me and I'll try to help you out, or I'll get you the right person. Or sometimes I might not have the answer, but I know there's a really great National Academy of Science report, and I'll say, you should check this out.
That's good. That works. That's not, it's the right thing to do as a human being, but it's also the best possible way to break through the polarization and to help somebody believe what they should believe.
Yeah. People just want to be respected, and they're inherently curious. And I will tell you, when you give somebody your business card and you say, email me, and then I tell them, I'm really crazy busy, I got three kids, blah, blah, blah. If I don't write back, email me again. It's okay. And then, you know, you eventually just give them something that you hope gets them on the right trajectory. And, you know, it's a very low cost, low risk, high outcome opportunity.
Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. It's really wonderful to have you both here together to share your collective wisdom and research and thoughts with us. Thank you. Lee McIntyre is a research fellow at the Center for Philosophy and History of Science at Boston University and a recent lecturer on ethics at Harvard Extension School. He's the author of How to Talk to a Science Denier, Post-Truth, and the forthcoming On Disinformation. Christopher Reddy is a senior scientist in the Department of Marine Chemistry and Geochemistry at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and a faculty member at MIT. He is the author of Science Communication in a Crisis, An Insider's Guide. And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.